Thanks so much. So, well, this time I cannot start my talk organizing, thanking, you know, the organizing committee for the conference for obvious reasons. So instead I'm going to start by thanking all of you for making this long travel to come to Waterloo and attend this celebration of the Kochensperger theorem. And on that note, what I'm going to talk about is a slightly generalization of contextuality scenarios, which are based more on the notion of operational equivalences. So hopefully by the end of the talk, those of you who are not familiar with this approach will at least understand what we mean when we talk about different formalisms for this type of Kochensperger contextuality. So the outline of the talk is the following. First, I'm going to present this hypergraph framework for contextuality. And then I'm going to mention how it relates to the two notions of contextuality or non-classicality that we've heard about today. So on the one hand, Bell non-locality, and on the other hand, scenarios where we have compatible observables. And then I will briefly comment on two different reasons why this framework is relevant. On the one hand, graph theoretic tools to answer some of the questions that we ask in this type of problems. And on the other hand, how to tackle, or how our formalism allows us to tackle the problem of how to characterize quantum correlations or quantum predictions from basic principles. So let's start by discussing what do we mean by a contextuality experiment here. So basically, the type of object that we have in mind is this one. So we have here some measurement device and some system. And what we do is we perform measurements on the system labeled by X, and we obtain outcomes here labeled by A. So basically, the information that we have in this type of experiment is the classical label of the measurements that we are performing and the classical labels of the outcomes that we obtain with such experiments. So that is our basic starting point. But now, if that is the only information that we want to have or that we want to rely on to tackle this problem of quantum predictions, then this is a very naive approach, because I don't have enough structure to actually make the problem interesting. So in order to do that, what we do is we include further equivalences between the events in this scenario. So what are the things that we identify? So basically, what we want to identify here are the outcomes of different measurements. So if we have different measurements, so different outcomes of different measurements, and this happens with the same probability for all possible preparations of the system, then we will regard those two events as being operationally equivalent. So here's perhaps an example of to try to express what I mean. So here I've depicted two different measurements. So each of these two ellipses are two different measurements. And these are the pictorial representations of the outcomes. So we have two measurements with three outcomes each. Mm-hmm. And now, let's suppose that we repeat these measurements many times in different possible preparations of our system. And we find that these two outcomes always happen with the same probability. So we have the same distribution for these two outcomes. So whenever that happens, we will regard those two events, so those two outcomes, as being operationally equivalent, and we will depict it as that. So basically there, we have two different measurements which have one outcome in common. So just to make a slight you know, this is a little bit different to what Rob was mentioning today, because he was actually making operational equivalences between two measurement devices. So here we are not saying that the two measurements are equivalent, but rather that these two particular outcomes of these two measurements are the ones that are rendered equivalent. For instance, in quantum theory, so an example in quantum theory would be when we have a measurement, and each of these outcomes is associated, for instance, a projector, and those three projectors sum up to the identity, and the same here. But now, if we have these two different measurements, which may be different realizations of the identity in terms of projectors, but we actually happen to share that same projector for these two outcomes, for those two different measurements, then we will always get the same probability, because they are associated the same measurement operator. So that's why in quantum theory those two events are regarded as equivalent, because the operators that those two outcomes are assigned are exactly the same. So somehow I highlighted in my example before how we will actually represent a contextuality scenario in this framework. So here, a contextuality scenario then will be thought of as a hypergraph where the vertices are the collection of all the measurement outcomes, which after this identification process have taken place. And then the hyperedges will cover all the possible outcomes of that particular measurement. So each hyperedge corresponds to a measurement of this scenario. Mm-hmm. So for instance, in this case, we have a contextuality scenario with three measurements of three outcomes each, that each of those share one outcome in common. So now that we have this picture in mind, remember that what we wanted to study was actually the statistics of obtaining an outcome when we perform a measurement, so which is the probability that a certain outcome will occur when a certain measurement is performed. So for that, let's study what are the possible probabilistic models or conditional probability distributions that may arise in such a setup. So if the only thing that we want is that these conditional probability distributions are well defined, then mathematically the only constraints that we have on which are the possible assignments of values between 0 and 1 to each of these measurement outcomes is merely given by these normalization conditions. So basically, what we want is we want to assign one number to each of these outcomes such that for each of the measurements, so for each hyperedge in this hypergraph, all those numbers sum to 1. So basically, that's the only consistency constraint that we have. Mm-hmm. So that is the minimum requirement for a conditional probability distribution to be well-defined or to be acceptable in this type of scenarios. So now one could take a step further and say, well, but that's not what we actually want. Now we want to study which are the possible models that can arise whenever my setup is classical, or whenever I have access to a quantum state, or whenever I might have something that goes beyond what quantum mechanics can explain. So let's start. That one there, for instance, that assignment of 1 to those vertices and 0 to all those other vertices is a well-defined and accepted conditional probability distribution. And the set of all those well-defined probability distributions defines a polytope. So now let's think of the possible correlations that we can measure whenever we have access to a classical device. So in this case, basically what we have is a system, and this system might be prepared as a combination or in one of different states. But each of those states, each of those hidden variables, lambda, will basically specify which outcome we can obtain whenever we measure a particular measurement. So basically here what we're saying is that basically, there exists an underlying description of our system where these measurements have a predetermined outcome that we must obtain when we perform them. And basically, what we prepare when we have this classical system in our lab is just a mixture of all those possible deterministic preparations. So at the end, every possible classical conditional probability distribution will be just a convex combination of these deterministic assignments. So a convex combination of these models that are the ones that represent these hidden variables that have predetermined outcomes for each of the measurements that you perform on your system. So for instance, that conditional probability distribution up there is an example not just of an allowed probabilistic model, but also of a deterministic one, because if you check, it has values, ones, and zeros everywhere. Mm-hmm. So it tells you which is the outcome that you must obtain when a certain measurement is performed. And the set of classical models, actually, is also a polytope, which lies inside the wand of general probabilistic models. So now comes the quantum bit. So for quantum assignments, then, when can we say that a certain correlation has a quantum realization? Or when do we say such statement within this framework? Well, if we have a general probabilistic model, we will say that it has a quantum realization if there exists a Hilbert space, a state on that Hilbert space, and an assignment of projectors to each of these measurement outcomes, such that the collection of those projectors for each of the hyperedges is a complete von Neumann measurement, and then that the probabilities of the original probabilistic model are recovered via the Born's rule. So basically, if someone comes and gives us a certain conditional probability distribution, and we can come up with a collection of projective measurements that satisfy those operational equivalences and that and the state, and which together they recover the statistics that we started with, then that has a quantum realization. And the set of quantumly allowed probabilistic models may be slightly larger than the classical one. So there exist scenarios where the inclusion between the classical and the quantum is strict. So what does it mean? So what does it mean if I perform an experiment and I measure a point which is there, like inside the quantum set but outside the classical one? Well, that would mean that the statistics that we've measured are incompatible with this characterization of the world, with this characterization of our system, that is, with non-contextual hidden variables that assign deterministic values to the measurements that we're performing. So basically, that is the setup of the framework. So now, how does this relate with the things that we heard about this morning, and why would we go through all the bother of trying to develop a framework if there are already some thoughts of how to deal with contextuality? So for that, let's start with Bell scenarios. So here now we will see how to think of Bell scenarios within this picture. So on the one hand, in the Bell scenario, what we have is, in this particular case, a set of n different parties. So we have n distant parties that perform space-like separated actions on the surface system. And here, by x, I denote their measurement choices, and by a, their measurement outcomes. So in a typical Bell experiment, the thing that we study, the object that we study, is this multipartite conditional probability distribution. So the probability that we obtain this collection of outcomes, given that we've performed this collection of measurements. Mm-hmm. So now, we would like to see this in this other way. So now we would like to see, to understand this bad experiment as one measurement, x, being performed on a system and an outcome A being obtained. So basically, we want to summarize this as the probability of A given X, where now A and X denote global events. Mm-hmm. So here, basically, here and throughout the talk, an event will be given by an outcome given a measurement, that is, a particular vertex of the hypergraph. So now, how do we represent this within this hypergraph framework? So basically, the question is, if we have a Bell scenario characterized by a certain number of parties that can choose among m measurements, each of these has the outcomes, how can we construct a hypergraph that recovers all the physics that we are interested in studying in the starting point Bell scenario? So for that, for instance, consider this particular case, a CHSH case, where we have two parties, Alice and Bob, each of which can choose between two measurements, which are dichotomic. So we have two dichotomic measurements for Alice and two dichotomic measurements for Bob. And now the question is, how can we construct the joint hypergraph that represents this scenario? And that, we were not actually the first people to ask such a question. And in graph theory, there are actually Fully and Randall who studied a similar question, but of course phrased differently. And basically, what you have to do is, given this local hypergraph for Alice and this local hypergraph for Bob, if you want to compute a joint hypergraph that captures the notions of space-like separation of the parties, then what you need to do is compute the Fully Randall product of those two individual hypergraphs. And if you do that, you end up with something that is a little bit more complicated than perhaps what one would have expected. But the good thing about this representation is the following. So on the one hand, it's not just a property of Bell scenarios. So now, if HA and HB can be whatever hypergraph in Alice and Bob's side, it doesn't have to be this joint measurements hypergraph that I showed you before, then the statement still holds. This product scenario will capture no signaling conditions between Alice and Bob. And moreover, whenever those individual local hypergraphs are these disjoint measurements ones, so the ones that actually represent the local situations for a Bell scenario, then we recover the following. If now we see which are the mathematically allowed, well-normalized probabilistic models on this hypergraph, then such a set actually coincides with the no signaling correlations in the initial Bell scenario. So somehow, all these hyperedges that are involved in multipartite generalizations of this fully rendered product capture the no signaling constraints between Alice and Bob. And moreover, if now we see which are the classical probabilistic models that this hypergraph allows, they actually coincide with those correlations in both scenarios that can be explained by local causality. So they have a realization in terms of local hidden variables. And finally, and more interestingly, the same happens for the set of quantum correlations. So if we have a quantum correlation in this allowed by this hypergraph, then that will have a realization as a quantum correlation in the original Bell scenario. And why do I say that this might sound surprising? Well, because if you remember what I said a couple of slides ago, in this hypergraph framework, what we do is we associate a projective measurement to each of the global events. So we associate a projector operator to each of these global events. And it is this normalization condition that we impose that allows us to have an equivalent realization in terms of products of local projectors. And those are the ones that are relevant when you study correlations in a Bell scenario. So the take-home message is, if you have different parties which are space-like separated and you want to recover non-signaling statistics in their joint scenario, just use the multipartite generalization of the fully random product and you will end up with these nice behaviors for Bell scenarios. Yes, Will?
Can you say again what the H sub K's were?
Oh, yes. So those H sub K, basically what I mean is, if you have, so basically you have a situation, you have Alice and Bob, and Alice, in a Bell scenario, what she does is she can choose among different measurements that have certain outcomes, but there is no any additional process of operationally identifying outcomes on her place. So in the case of a Bell scenario, you just have these joint measurements. But then you could, it could also be the case that you can take a step forward and say, well, now I want to consider a more complicated situation where now, at the level of the individual labs, I want to moreover test if there are further operational equivalences between Alice's measurements or among Bob's measurements, and now I want to be able to translate those operational equivalences that I find into the joint scenario as well.
So it's for M outcomes and D measurements?
This general thing, no. That's, you're not thinking of a Bell scenario anymore.
So what is N?
Oh, that's the number of parties, that's the number of measurements, and that's the number of outcomes.
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. Okay, so that's how to think about Bell scenarios or space-like separated parties. Now, how do we think of compatible observables within this approach? As we heard in the previous talk by Samson, such a scenario can be characterized by the set of measurements that you can, the set of observables or measurements that you can choose from, the set of outcomes that those measurements have, and the measurement cover, M, that tell you which measurements are compatible with which. So basically, every element of this set M is a context that you can measure. So now, how do we relate this with the hypergraph approach? Well, as an example, which is the example that I will try to keep through the rest of the talk, let's take Speckle's triangle. So we have, as the set of possible observables, A, B, and C, and as the set of possible context, A, B, B, C, and A, C. So basically, we have three observables that we can measure any two together, but we cannot measure all the three together. So they are triplewise incompatible, but pairwise compatible. So now, just like I explained before for Bell scenarios, the question is, given this traditional definition of a scenario, in this case a compatible observables one, how can we create a hypergraph that captures the notions of the statistics that we want to study and their properties? So let's start with the vertices, which are the easiest to characterize, just as in the Bell scenario case. So here, every vertex will be given by a collection of outcomes for each of the contexts. So that is what defines an event in this scenario, and each of those is going to give us a vertex in this hypergraph. So in this Speckle triangles case, then, the vertices will be given by all the possible outcomes AB when A and B are measured together, because they are compatible, so we measure them together. The same with B and C, and the same with AC. So each choice of outcome will define a vertex, an event, and the collection of all the possible outcomes for all these possible contexts will give us a set of all the vertices in this scenario. Now, the convoluted bit is how to define hyperedges, which is not going to be that straightforward as we saw in the case of Bell scenarios. So for this, I need to define the notion of a measurement protocol. So a measurement protocol consists of the following. So first, we pick an observable to measure. We measure that observable and obtain an outcome. Now, depending on that outcome that we've just obtained, we may choose among all those observables compatible with the one that I've just measured, and we choose one to perform. Which one will be a function of the outcome that I just obtained? Now, I choose that one, I measure that observable, obtain another outcome, and now, depending on that outcome, I may choose from a list of observables that are compatible with the two that I've just measured. And of course, the one that I will measure will depend on the outcome that I obtained for this second observable. And so on. Whenever you've run out of possibilities, so when you've reached a branch in this tree, that there are no more observables that are compatible with all the ones that I've just measured, then the protocol stops. That is the notion of a measurement protocol. So each choice of initial observable and choice of which functions will give me the next step, each choice of that collection of parameters is what defines a protocol. For instance, here in the Speckers triangle, we can have the following protocol. We start with observable A, and then if the outcome is 0, I measure observable B, and if the outcome is 1, I measure observable C. Now, once that I've measured B, the only observable I have left that I could choose from here in my set X is C, but C is not compatible with both A and B. Therefore, I cannot choose any other compatible observable, and the protocol stops here. And the same reasoning applies once that I've measured A and C. There is nothing left for me to measure which are compatible with both A and C at the same time. Therefore, the protocol stops there. So for this particular choice of initial observable and function that tells me what to measure next in terms of the outcome that I just obtained, that particular protocol gives me this set of outcomes. So those are all the possible events that can be generated by this fixed protocol that I defined. And then, basically, this collection here will give us one of the hyperedges in this hypergraph. To compute all the possible hyperedges that represent measurements in this compatible observables approach, then one would need to run over all the possible measurement protocols, and each measurement protocol will give us a hyperedge of that form. Now, if we take that as a definition, so if when we start from an observables, compatible observables scenario, we construct now a hypergraph that consists of the following. So these outcomes given the context are the vertices, and measurement protocols are the ones that define the hyperedges of the hypergraph. Then we can prove the following. So these empirical models that Samson was talking about, which basically assign a probability to each of the contexts, and the consistency condition is that the marginals coincide on the part of the context that they overlap. So those empirical models, so we have an empirical model if and only if that same statistics can be recovered as a general probabilistic model in our scenario, in the hypergraph. So basically, that is the way to think of a compatible observable scenario within this hypergraph framework. So now that we have that definition, now that we know what a general scenario is, now that we know how Bell scenarios fit in the picture, and now that we know how starting from compatibility relations shift the problem into this hypergraph language, what do we do? So why did we go through all the bother of doing all this? Well, first, we have the advantage of graph theory that allows us to answer some questions that we ask in these type of situations. But for that, first I will need to briefly define what a non-orthogonality graph is for a given scenario. So basically, for this, the hypergraph that represents the contextuality scenario, what we do now is we take a graph that consists of the same vertices as the original hypergraph, but now we don't have hyperedges anymore, we have just edges. And two vertices share an edge if they didn't share a hyperedge in the original scenario. So basically, this is somehow captures the complementary property of what Adán was saying this morning. So this is basically the complement of the exclusivity graph that he was mentioning. So one could think that, well, when we go from here to here, we certainly lose information about the original scenario. But even if we do so, it's the amount of information that we have here about the original scenario is still enough to allow us to say interesting things. So, for instance, if we want to ask the question of whether a collection of the statistics that we see in our experiment, if they are consistent with a classical explanation, and by classical I mean deterministic non-contextual hidden variable models, then it is enough to just take this non-orthogonality graph, apply some weights to the vertices given by the probabilities that we've obtained in our experiment, and take what is the value of the fractional packing number of such a weighted graph. If that value happens to be 1, then we know that our statistics have a classical explanation. So this is one example of how tools from graph theory can help us make inference on how, which are the possible explanations of the statistics that we see. And now you can get all excited about, oh, can we do something similar for the quantum case? And don't get too excited, because the answer is no. And actually, it's not that we couldn't find a graph invariant that would do the trick, but we were actually able to prove that there's no graph invariant of this weighted non-orthogonality graph that will help us decide whether whether statistics are compatible with a quantum realization. And for that, basically what we did is we took a probabilistic model and two contextuality scenarios, H and H prime, and we noticed that for one scenario, that model is quantum, but for another scenario, H prime, is outside the quantum set. And these two scenarios, H and H prime, have the property that their orthogonality graphs or non-orthogonality graphs coincide. So basically, if we only have access to this information, which is the non-orthogonality graph, and the model itself, then we cannot say if it has a quantum realization or not. But, well, the fact that we cannot find a graph invariant that does the trick is also not entirely surprising, in the sense that deciding whether or not a probabilistic model has a quantum realization is not an easy problem. And I think that we might talk about it tomorrow, so let's wait for his talk. But yeah, do not expect to have an easy characterization of this quantum set. So if we do not have an easy characterization of the quantum set, why don't we study other relevant sets which do have an easy characterization? So for that, let me introduce you our beloved, or not entirely beloved, it depends on the person, almost quantum set. So basically, this almost quantum, or in this contextuality framework, Q1 correlations, are a set that is slightly larger than the quantum set, so it's that blue line there. And it was first studied within the MPI hierarchy. So So we have the NPA hierarchy to try to characterize correlations in a bus scenario. So basically, that was the 1 plus AB level in the original NPA paper. And then it was further extended to multipartite Bayes scenarios in the work by Navasquez, Gurianova, Hovan, and Asin. And here, within our framework, we generalize this notion of almost quantum correlations to these type of contextuality scenarios, and we denoted them by Q1. So why is this set relevant? Well, the thing is that, as we were discussing this morning, there is this approach or this research line of trying to characterize quantum correlations, so the statistics that you see in such experiments, only from basic principles. So not relying on the underlying mathematical description, but only from physical principles or information theoretic principles. And somehow, all the principles that have been proposed so far, they do not characterize quantum correlations. All of them prove to be satisfied by almost quantum, the almost quantum set. So a relevant thing is to study how this almost quantum now relates to the quantum set. But that is what makes this almost quantum set of behaviors interesting. Somehow, all the attempts that we managed to characterize quantum characterize this almost quantum one, so there is something that we are missing there. So there are many definitions of this Q1 set. As I mentioned before, it has appeared in many opportunities. But the one that might be easier to say within this framework is the following. So basically, we say that an assignment of probabilities to each of the vertices of a hypergraph, that means to each of the outcomes of a contextuality scenario, has a Q1 realization if there exists a Hilbert space, a density operator for the system, and an assignment of projectors to each of those vertices of a hypergraph, such that now the sum of the projectors are upper bounded by the identity for each of the hyperedges, that is, each of the measurements, and the probabilities are recovered via the Born's rule. So this is almost exactly the same as the definition of quantum correlations, of quantum probabilistic models, but apart from this sign here. So basically, in the quantum case, we want this to be an equality, so we want these projectors to define a complete phone number measurement for each of the hyperedges, whereas here, we do not demand that. Notice that even though the projectors are not normalized for each of the hyperedges, probabilities do, because we started from a valid, normalized, conditional probability distribution. So basically, we have normalized correlations, and somehow we explain them in terms of unnormalized von Neumann measurements. And now the good thing about this approach is that deciding whether a set of conditional probability distribution has a realization in terms of these Q1 models, it's a very easy thing. So basically, you take the non-orthogonality graph weighted by this assignment of probabilities, and you compute now the Lobach number, which is an SDP, so it's something in principle easy to compute. And if that number is 1, then you're done. The correlations belong to the Q1 set. So somehow this Lobach number is related to the characterization of almost quantum correlations. There exist scenarios where it happens that quantum correlations coincide with almost quantum ones, so somehow the almost quantum set collapses into the quantum set. And for those particular cases, you could characterize quantum correlations in terms of this SDP, but it only works for a very limited family of hypergraphs. So not all of them will admit such a characterization for quantum correlations. So now this was somehow the first part of the why we care about developing such a framework. And now the other one, so the other part of the talk is how does this help us with the question of characterizing quantum correlations from basic principles. So the first principle that I'm going to talk about, which is very well suited for this framework, is the consistent exclusivity. And actually, I'm going to mention it first because it has a nice connection with this graph invariance that I was telling you about in the previous slide. So what is the consistent exclusivity principle? So basically, consistent exclusivity defines a notion of exclusiveness among events in a scenario. So basically, two events in a scenario are exclusive if there exists a hyperedge that contains them both. So if those two different outcomes are outcomes of a same measurement. Mm-hmm. And then CE also imposes a constraint on sets of pairwise exclusive events. So basically, when you have a set of pairwise exclusive events, then the sum of the probabilities has to be upper bounded by one. Mm-hmm. So basically, this is the consistent exclusivity principle. So now the question is, how do we impose it in given a contextuality scenario? Well, the first naive thing that you could try to do is just say, well, you know, these are the measurements that I'm performing, these are the outcomes, these are my events, and I want to see if now, given these events and these relations here, if I satisfy those constraints. Mm-hmm. That's something that you can do. You can take the statistics of your experiment, test for the events that you have, if those sets of exclusive events satisfy this condition. So that is a straightforward thing to do. But for instance, if now you go and you take such an approach for CHSH, so if you take the hypergraph that corresponds to a Bell scenario, CHSH scenario, and you take the Pierre box, which is the most non-local box in this scenario, then you can actually check that it satisfies this constraint. So even though we have a principle and we have a straightforward way to apply it, there exists a situation where it's not that useful in the sense that it allows for most very strongly non-local boxes. So there is something more that you can do. So you can be smart and say, well, but how about now I take not just one copy of my device? I could also think or conceive of a situation where I have two independent boxes, so two independent contextuality scenarios that locally are the same. And in such a situation now, I have a joint probability distribution for these two outcomes given these two inputs. But since these two are independent situations, they are tensor scenarios, then actually this correlation will be the product of the two individual ones. Mm-hmm. So basically, this will be somehow a kind of a squared problem involving these individual single system statistics. And now we can ask the question, well, does these correlations here, those correlations in this two-copy scenario, satisfy the consistent exclusivity principle in this larger scenario? So that will impose non-trivial constraints which are different from these ones at the level of these single correlations here. And whenever these joint correlations satisfy all those constraints, we say that the initial single box correlations satisfies the principle at the level of two copies. Mm-hmm. And of course, you don't need to restrict yourself to two copies. You can take any number of copies of these boxes as you like. And that will define an application of the consistent exclusivity principle at different levels of copy scenarios. So from a graph theoretical point of view, the set of pairways mutually exclusive events are actually given by the independent sets of the non-orthogonality graph. So basically, we can rephrase the consistent exclusivity principle as a linear constraint on the sum of the weights of this non-orthogonality graph for each of the independent sets that it has. Mm-hmm. And now, using the machinery that we inherited from graph theory, we can prove the following. So the set of statistics, so the probabilistic models that satisfy the consistent exclusivity principle at the level of one copy, are those for which the independence number of the weighted non-orthogonality graph is 1. And now you can make similar claims. So if now you want to see if a conditional probability distribution satisfies the principle at the level of k copies, what you need to do is to take the tensor product of the probabilities as the weights for your vertices, and now take the strong product of the non-orthogonality graph with itself. And that is the object that you will ask for its independence number. Whenever it's 1, then your correlation satisfies CE at the level of k copies. And more interestingly, when you want to check that at the level of what happens when you take a limit of infinite copies, then the object that you need to study is actually the Shannon capacity. So whether a conditional probability distribution satisfies consistent exclusivity at the level of an infinite number of copies, then what you need to do is to compute the Shannon capacity and see if it is equal to 1. So this is how this graph theoretical approach allows us to make claims about how capable is this principle, this consistent exclusivity principle, to characterize quantum correlations. And using the relation that the Lobach number is always larger than the Shannon capacity of a graph, then we reach the conclusion that almost quantum models, Q1 models, satisfy the consistent exclusivity principle at the level of any number of copies of your device. So the consistent exclusivity principle alone is not enough to single out almost quantum models, let alone quantum ones. So now the last principle that I want to discuss is macroscopic non-contextuality. So basically, this macroscopic non-contextuality principle is an extension of macroscopic locality for contextuality scenarios and consists of the following. So let's take this picture where we have a measurement device and we have a system, so we have a source that prepares a system, enters the measurement device, and then somehow these detectors will click depending on which is the measurement outcome that this device has produced. So for instance, you could think of this as a Stern-Gerlach. Well, you send an electron and then it will divide into spin up or spin down. So this will the possible measurements that we can perform and the operational equivalences between these measurements will define the contextuality scenario, and then we can study which are the possible probabilistic models in such scenario. And now what we do is we picture a macroscopic realization of this experiment. So now we think of the case where now we have a source that emits not one, but prepares n different independent systems, and they all enter the measurement device, and this measurement device interacts with those systems independently. And then what we see is not just a click or no click, but rather a distribution of intensities, which tells us roughly how many systems have gone to one detector and how many have gone to the other. So somehow this measure of intensities, which is what this experiment gives rise to, is somehow related with which is the probability that a single system will end up in one detector. So somehow these statistics over these intensities that we measure in this macroscopic version of the scenario will depend on which is the microscopic version of the experiment, so which is the statistics for a single preparation system. So basically, the macroscopic non-contextuality principle tells that whenever we take n going to infinity, then the correlations that we will see, so this conditional probability distribution here, will be non-contextual. That is what the principle says, that when we take an infinite number of systems that enter our device, so if we are in a somehow macroscopic realm, then all that we can see is classical, so basically non-contextual. And imposing non-contextuality at the level of these macroscopic probabilities imposes constraints at the level of which are the allowed microscopic statistics that you can observe. And you can prove that a conditional probability distribution satisfies the principle if and only if it belongs to the set Q1. So this is actually the first time that we were able to characterize Q1 correlations fully. So basically, this is like another rephrasing of what these almost quantum correlations are. But still, it's not enough. This type of macroscopic limit is not enough to fully characterize only the set of quantum correlations. So that leads me to the end of my talk. So basically, what I did is I presented a framework which is based on hypergraphs, and it takes into account operational equivalences among measurement outcomes. And it allows you to unify the notions of what a Bell scenario is and what compatible observables approach is and how to study all this, these two non-classical phenomena under the same umbrella. And as I hope I managed to convey, is that it has a useful connection to graph theory. Still, this is a fairly new approach, so we still don't know what it's fully capable of, and there are still many open questions. One of the main ones that we still struggle with is how to define temporal scenarios. So basically, what I was telling you today is how to combine different contextuality scenarios when we have space-like separated parties. But now, how do we take into account a different situation now where we want some arrow of time? So how to, given an experiment that tries to reveal non-classicality of a system, but that involves sequences of measurements, how to understand such a thing within this type of hypergraph approach is something that is still not fully understood. Now, there's also the open problem of how to characterize quantum predictions from basic physical principles. And one of the questions is not just to how to create these principles, but whether this framework may or may not provide a useful platform to formulate those principles on. And particularly, what we want to do is we want to distinguish quantum from almost quantum correlations, since somehow this whole discussion of consistent exclusivity and finally macroscopic non-contextuality managed to characterize almost quantum correlations. And last but not least, applications. So whether, how can we, so now that we have a different picture of how to understand contextuality, if this will provide us new insight on what contextuality is useful for. And with that, thank you very much for your attention.
Some papers report violations of inequalities that are in analogy with non-contextuality and non-locality inequalities, but with classical life.
With what?
I mean, you can construct inequalities, for instance, CHSH inequality, but not for single photons or systems like that, but for classical light, coherent light. And in light of that, why to impose macroscopically non-contextuality?
Do you need to? Okay. So I think that the so basically with the problem that I see with these experiments that want to tackle Bell inequalities with now, for instance, waves, is that we are rephrasing. So basically, we want to have an experiment where we want to compare something that is quantum with something that is classical, but on the same footage. So allowing classical to be, for instance, a wave rather than a particle, and then leaving the quantum version as just the particle side is not, it's like comparing apples with oranges. It's like saying, well, I have, for instance, this the two-slit experiment, and I say, well, I send single particles, and I see this interference pattern on the screen. And then someone can come and say, well, I put a classical wave, and I can see the same thing. Well, but here we are comparing waves with single quantum particles instead of single classical particles with single quantum particles.
Okay, right.
So that's why the fact that there are classical systems that could somehow behave quantumly, but because you're allowing them to give extra freedom, is something that you need to be careful.
Okay.
So when we define this principle, what we do is we define a macroscopic limit where the macroscopic bit is such that these very powerful classical analogs are not included somehow.
Okay, but you can think about these classical analogs are a limit with, I don't know, a very large number of photons, right? I mean, not only that, but you can think about that. I mean, if you think that a macroscopical system is just a lot of single copies of a quantum system,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I cannot see why to impose non-contextuality to such a system of a lot of single quantum systems. Right? I think I'm missing something.
Well, basically what we are trying to say is that if you take a macroscopic object, that object, which is composed of many individual bits, should behave classically.
Okay.
That's basically what we say. We don't say that there couldn't exist a wave that would generate perhaps statistics that are not compatible with a non-contextual single particle classical experiment. We're saying that if we have a set of particles that do not have this, they're not a wave, they're a collection of particles, that they should somehow tend to a classical explanation. That's basically what we say.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
Thanks, Belen, for the very nice presentation. I have just a question or slash comment on the last
mm-hmm.
part of the quantum from principle.
Yes.
Because you said, I mean, almost quantum kind of passed undetected by all the principles that have been proposed.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not quite exact if you think that we do have axiomatizations of quantum theory.
Oh, no,
so
okay, no.
We do have a principle to get the whole thing.
Okay,
no.
I'm not talking about the axiomatizations of quantum theory, no.
I know.
If you think of the axiomatization of quantum theory,
yeah.
Basically you have these axioms, you recover quantum theory, and then when you go back to correlations, you rule out almost quantum.
Yes.
But now if you want to somehow define device-independent principle, so to say, then that bit is not quite recovering the full quantumness.
Sure. So, I know that
yeah.
that was the reason.
Oh, yeah, sorry if it's
not,
it was not clear.
But my question on this is now this. So, in the contextuality scenarios, any of these principles is not really device-independent.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, I mean, the motivation of we need more principle because we need them to be device-independent doesn't apply here. From the very beginning, you defined the framework from operational equivalence.
Mm-hmm.
So same measurement for all preparation. This was just
The contextuality bit is device dependent. It's not device independent.
Yes.
But when I have these quantum perform principles in mind, perhaps I'm implicitly focusing on Bell scenarios. Yeah.
I see. I understand.
Perhaps that's why I was thinking of this macroscopic contextuality
yes.
as
so
an extension of...
That's kind of a legitimate question to ask mm-hmm. if we can do it in a device independent
yep.
way. Thanks, that was the question.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we'll take one more question, but if we can, to connect
yes.
to
yes.